You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. President Trump has released his long-anticipated infrastructure plan, but Congress seems less than enthusiastic about it. So we thought we'd take this opportunity to explore some alternative ideas about infrastructure, specifically what the infrastructure of the future might look like and how we get from here to there. Joining me now via Skype is Mark Stevenson. He is a self-described reluctant futurist and an optimist. He's author of An Optimist's Tour of the Future and We Do Things Differently, The Outsiders Rebooting Our World. Mark, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Some infrastructure, if we look around the world right now, has changed dramatically even just in the past decade or so. I mean, our cell phones, our computer and internet infrastructure, you know, top of mind there. But then other parts of our infrastructure, like maybe our highway system, look pretty much the same as they did, you know, 85 years ago. It's still paved roads. What types of infrastructure do you see changing most dramatically in, say, the next 30 years? And what's driving those shifts?
The biggest shift will be in the energy infrastructure. So just on an economic basis now, renewables, solar, wind are going to totally change the way we think about energy, who owns it, who generates it, how much it costs. So you're going to see a move worldwide to a distributed energy system, to an energy internet where anybody with a solar panel will be able to play in the energy markets and sell stuff to their neighbors at the cost and they decide rather than the middleman. It's going to be very, very bad for the big utilities, very, very bad for Vladimir Putin. But very, very good for citizens because it will also massively reduce the cost of energy. And when you reduce the cost of energy, you boost the economy. It's also a much safer way of generating energy because it's a lot less susceptible to attack. So I think that's going to be the biggest infrastructure shift, and we're going to see that worldwide.
One thing you didn't really mention in there that's got to be part of the equation in that shift is climate change. And you have said and written that our current systems, not just our energy system, but education, healthcare, a whole host of different systems are failing or crumbling under the weight of the challenges that we face right now. And yet you also say that you're an optimist about where we're headed.
Well, people call me an optimist, but I'm not really. in that I certainly believe it is entirely possible that we can have a much more sustainable, just, humane and equitable world. And the technologies and ways of thinking to do that are out there. And I spent a lot of my life finding those people and technologies and shining a light on them and trying to help them. But it is also entirely possible that we could go to hell in a handcart if we don't deal with the things that are happening at the moment. So the problem we have is that the status quo is very well funded. And it's very hard to get somebody to understand something when their salary depends on them not understanding it. So this is why old systems take a long time to die. But you know, these systems will collapse out of necessity because they've proved themselves wholly incapable of dealing with the grand challenges we have. They'll either collapse because they just don't work anymore, or we can slowly replace them with something better. I prefer the second option because I think a lot less citizens of the world, particularly the poorer citizens, will be hurt by doing it that way.
I definitely want to get some of your examples of how we can make those changes, but I think we should take a step back first. You said grand challenges, plural. Besides climate change, what other grand challenges are there that we need to be thinking about?
Well, there's this massive retreat of democracy around the world, essentially because we're still using sort of 18th or 19th century systems of governance to try and handle 21st century challenges. Which means that, for instance, in the US, only 9% of citizens have anything like a positive view of Congress. And it's no better in my country. We have a mass inequality where 1% of the population own 50% of the world's wealth. We have an education system that in most countries still seems stuck in the 1950s. We have the wholesale erosion of the soils all around the world at a startling rate, which means we've probably only got 100 harvests left unless we start to rethink our agriculture system. And the water table is dropping all around the world because our agriculture is so thirsty. And now half of the world's population live under water stress, almost as a direct result of that. You know, and that's just the beginning.
Okay, so it's easy to see how it could be hard to be an optimist. I'm talking with futurist and maybe optimist Mark Stevenson, author of An Optimist Tour of the Future and We Do Things Differently, The Outsiders Rebooting Our World. That most recent book of yours was, you know, you going around the world and meeting people who are finding ways to address these challenges. So let's talk about a few of those. Education system of the 1950s being what you feel we're stuck in. We talk about the classroom of the future, but that tends to be kind of an iterative change, you know, that we would have maybe more computers doing the teaching instead of teachers, but we're still in a classroom. Are we thinking too small? Do we need to be thinking bigger? Is education not even in a classroom in the future, perhaps?
So sticking kids in a classroom is a really efficient way to teach, but it's a terrible way to learn.
It's certainly not my kids' favorite idea.
No, indeed. And what we all know, you know, when we get out into the real world is we learn best in teams. We learn from our peers. We learn in a group dynamic. And there is some of that happening in schools, but not nearly enough. The other problem with the school system is, and this is a problem with a lot of our systems, is that what they value is what they can measure. And unfortunately, the skills of the future, those of collaboration, empathy, teamwork, asking the right questions, thinking systemically, in fact, all the things that machines can't do, those skills are very hard to measure. And therefore, they're not very, very much valued by public education systems because they don't know how to report on what they're doing. So we have this concentration on things like numeracy and literacy, which I'm a huge fan of, by the way. I think they're very important. But we have those at the expense of the problem-solving, empathetic, teamworking skills, which are exactly the skills we need in order to solve the problems that we've got.
All right, so let's tackle a different one. Food. This idea that we may only have 100 harvests left going the way that we're currently going, that is a dire prediction. We've had the Green Revolution once. Are we talking about genetically modified seeds to deal with this? Or what are some of the solutions that you are finding out there for food shortages?
You know, Norman Borlaug, the guy behind the Green Revolution, you know, there's never been a more controversial person who's won the Nobel Prize, as far as I can work out, because he did indeed help us, you know, create a sort of an industrial agriculture that did indeed save billions of people from starvation, particularly in China. The problem is it comes with a massive sustainability headache. The seeds we use and the crops we use, they only give these high yields if you give them lots of water, you give them fertilizer, you do this monocropping, which then attracts all the pests that like that particular thing. So then you have to create pesticides to deal with those pests, and then they evolve around those pesticides, and you get on the pesticide treadmill. So what we've done is we've tried to increase our yields by basically removing nature as much as possible from the farming process. And that's worked for a bit, but I kind of compare it to, you know, you can get an athlete to perform really well if you pump them full of drugs for, you know, a number of seasons, as, you know, Vladimir Putin well knows. But after a while, it doesn't work. It falls over. And our soils are leaching away in a large part because the fertilizers we're using are destroying the integrity of the soil. So soil erosion is now greater than the rotting that used to replace that soil. So the solution is actually to work with nature rather than against it. I mean, everybody knows that nature is incredibly good at growing stuff. The world is very, very green. There is now this science of agroecology, which is a much more nuanced understanding of how nature works, how it works in ecosystems, and then tweaking that here and there, sometimes with a bit of GM, sometimes maybe with a bit of fertilizer, sometimes not, though. And you can get the same kind of yields without the sustainability headache. And I've been to see this all around the world. But what's particularly good about it is that technology is available to the world's poorest. It doesn't involve a farmer having to buy expensive seeds or equipment or anything. You just have to have a bit different knowledge. And given that, you know, 56% of the world's food is still made on small farms, and that's 500 million families, you know, often living near poverty. If you can give them these new techniques, which say double or triple their yields, not only are you helping us solve that sustainability crisis, you're lifting hundreds of families out of poverty or away from danger, which is good for the economy, and it's good from a human rights perspective as well.
All right, let's talk about healthcare. This is one where actually you came to Boston to find innovations in our healthcare system. What kinds of innovations and changes are you thinking about and seeing in terms of healthcare?
Well, I think there's two key things that are wrong with healthcare. First, it's not really healthcare, it's sick care. Our healthcare system isn't there to keep you healthy, it's there to make a profit out of you when you get sick. And it turns out that patients themselves have a whole bunch of knowledge about managing their conditions. that isn't really well valued. So I came to Boston to see a network called Patients Like Me, which allows patients, basically almost like a dating service for people who have the same kind of disease as you. And what happens is when these patients get together and compare their notes and their data, they find that they have these incredible outcomes. They start to manage their conditions better. And it's more powerful than any drug in terms of the outcomes and reductions of admissions to hospital. So integrating patients into the healthcare system in a much more intelligent way is a really good thing to do. The most underutilized resource in healthcare is indeed the patient.
My guest is Mark Stevenson. He's author of An Optimist Tour of the Future and We Do Things Differently, The Outsiders Rebooting Our World. In all three of those cases that we just talked about, education, food production, and healthcare, you're talking about major innovations, but at the same time, you're still talking about there being schools and farms and hospitals, right? Not fundamentally blowing up and starting over with these different sectors. What are the systems that we need in place, kind of one level underneath that, to be able to innovate in all of these different spaces? What societal changes need to happen to foster more innovation?
Well, I think there's two things. The first is we need new governance systems, because the speed of governance is nowhere near as fast as the speed of technology or the speed of the challenges that are bearing down upon us. And there are models of improving that I look at in the book, particularly participatory democracy. And the second thing, which is hugely important, in fact, I'm sat in Amsterdam right now trying to deal with part of this problem, is the way the money thinks. So if the money thinks that short-term profit is better than the survival of the species, then guess what? That's where we'll go. But I am now sitting in Amsterdam with some very enlightened investors who are creating investment vehicles that not only make a tidy profit, but also are supporting the sustainable development goals of the UN. And that's something that I've really seen a shift of in the last two or three years, an enlightenment of a increasing section of the banking investment community who realize that that model is kind of broken systemically and morally, and they're trying to do things about it. And that gives me an awful lot of hope.
Well, to that point, you mentioned earlier that what is valued is what can be measured. And I take the point that it can be harder to measure some of these other things that you're saying we should be valuing. But at the same time, we need metrics, right, to gauge whether or not we're actually doing what we think we're doing or whether we're actually improving. What kind of metrics would you like to see being used more broadly to gauge whether we are moving in the right direction?
Well, I mean, very luckily, the UN has come up with a whole bunch of metrics that sit underneath the Sustainable Development Goals, which you can use. But I would like us to move to a much more principled way of thinking about the world. So organizations that move very fast tend not to judge their employees on, you know, whether you've got this performance rating or whatever. They say, did you follow the principles of the organization? Do your peers think that you are putting sustainability, justice, professionalship above a short-term gain? And I think that our ability to measure each other and our direction is a much, much more humane way of going. And organizations that do that seem to outperform the market anyway.
That, though, would require that we somehow on a broad scale agree on some values and principles. And I hate to say it, but it seems like at this point that would be a huge innovation in and of itself. We seem to be moving in the direction of more and more polarization, less agreement. Do you see any evidence that we could get to a place where we have those principles and ethics and standards that we could agree on?
Yeah, very much so. And the reason I believe that is in all my work, when I'm traveling around the world, finding people who found, you know, solutions or parts of the solution, what you tend to find is that people divided by politics are very soon brought together around projects. It turns out that you can get Donald Trump's biggest fan and Hillary Clinton's biggest fan in the same room, and you ask them to build something and their politics will pretty much disappear. They'll agree pretty much on where the school needs to be or whether there needs to be a light on that pavement or whatever the thing is. So, you know, we have this problem with our politics and our media in that the politics of division and the media division is very cheap. But in all the places I see where things get working, the politics almost disappears because people have got together around a project.
That is a reluctant futurist and possible optimist, Mark Stevenson. He's author of An Optimist Tour of the Future and We Do Things Differently, The Outsiders Rebooting Our World. He joined us via Skype. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having us. Great interview.
Up next, marrying Thoreau's Walden and today's Walden Pond. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.